Dave, I got to tell you one more story about my trip to Michigan. Are you ready for this?
I'm in for 5 more years of Michigan stories. You sold me.
This was beautiful. I'm over at it, and it's very, very genuine and sincere, and it just shows how different I grew up in this, and now it feels so foreign to me. And I'll tell you what I mean. I went over to my brother's house and to see him and his family. And they've got this gorgeous house out in the country. Lots of acreage. Just a very, very beautiful house. And they just welcomed their first son. And they're in the throes of toddlerhood and everything. And it's a great joy to watch. And they've got kind of what I would call a formal living room. In other words, they've got that living room where all the really good furniture and stuff is. And it's decorated just so. And my brother's a hunter.
That's the room where if you grew up with any Italian friends, the mom or the grandmother would have it with just covered in plastic. Everything was covered in plastic,
yep,
that room.
Yep, that's exact. But in this case, it's covered in animal stuff. In other words, he's a hunter. So there, right at the focal point above the fireplace are three big mounted deer heads with these huge antlers, right? And of course, at different places around the other places in the room, there might be, you know, deer type stuff, you know, maybe an antler here or there. But every time I walk into my brother's house, it always reminds me from that line of from that Disney's Beauty and the Beast music where they're talking about Gaston. Gaston? Yeah, that's his name, Gaston. I almost called him Gustav. And they say he uses antlers in all of his decorating. And right. I always think about that one line when I walk in my brother's house. And the central deer with this incredible rack has a red tag on its ear.
I'm sorry.
That's what you call a bunch of antlers. You call them a rack.
Anytime you hear the phrase incredible rack and you don't get a little nervous, that's the one time in life is when you're talking about deer. All right.
So it's got this, and I said, what's the story behind the red tag on the ear? He goes, oh my gosh, we never told you that? And I'm like, no. He goes, we spotted that. He goes, Uncle Elmer, this one, all roads lead back to Uncle Elmer. Uncle Elmer found that deer in the field, and it was like partially injured. And he brought it in and he put the tag on its ear, and we nursed it back to health. And we've got pictures of Grandma Geiger, who sadly is long departed, feeding this deer with a bottle, cradling it in her arms, feeding Aww. It with a bottle. And they bring out this picture, and sure enough, I've seen this picture before of Grandma Geiger nursing this deer with a bottle, and the deer's got the little red tag. And he goes, years later, I'm in the woods, and it's hunting season, and I see this buck, and I shoot it, and I go up, and he goes, oh, my God, that's Uncle Elmer's deer. And everybody was thrilled that he had gotten the deer that they had saved from death. And I'm like, there's something that's beautiful about there, and that's something that's really like twisted. Adam's family about that.
Yeah, twisted. Twisted is the word you're looking for. And there's Cousin JoJo. We loved him so much. He's also up on the wall.
Yeah, he had a brush with cancer, but thank God he made it. Shot him a year later.
I got to tell you, I have to apologize to you as a friend because this is the Irish in me coming out. A couple weeks ago, I did not know that your grandmother had passed, and I have to apologize to you because I had made some passing remark. And boy, if there was one thing my Irish grandparents always drilled into me was that you do not speak ill of the dead. And I apologize to you for that, my friend. I'm sorry about that.
There is no need. If there was anybody who had a broad, amazing sense of humor, it was Grandma Geiger. So you don't have to worry in the slightest about offending.
The weird thing about growing up with Irish grandparents is that they would, in life, they would be like, that son of a bitch, right? He's no good. I don't like him. He's a terrible human being. But then someone would die and be like, oh, well, God bless him. He was a good, he did his best, right? May the Lord take him into his hands. I hope he has a good life in the afterlife there because he tried his best. In life, though, they're like, I'd kill him with a spoon, I would. That man's a terrible human being. I don't love him at all. And as soon as they die, the Irish mysticism kicks in. We're like, oh, no, he's fine. He was a good man. Yeah. He tried his best. Oh.
God love him. Yeah,
God and love him. He had a lot of trouble.
That works itself right into that Midwest tendency of you can say anything you want, something horrible about somebody, if you follow it with God love them, then that's okay. You know, yeah. Boy, she's as ugly as a mud fence, God love her. It's like, wait
a minute. Ugly as a mud fence? I've never heard that. That's amazing. Ugly as a mud fence. I don't even know how to process that, but it just works as a joke.
Yeah. And ugly second only to dumb as a bag of hammers. That's another one I love.
I've heard dumb as a bag of hammers. That was great. Ugly as a mud fence. I don't even know what a mud fence is. It's just a fence covered with mud.
It's a fence. And I'll tell you what, it ain't pretty.
Well, on that note, friends, hi, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about mud fences and making comics.
And mud fences and making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing guilty today. I'm doing guilty.
Your Irish is really coming out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, why? Why are you feeling guilty, Dave? No reason at all. I'm just of Irish descent, so I feel guilty all the time. No, the reason I feel guilty, Brad, is I was up till 2 a.m. cartooning last night for scheduling reasons. And so I was cartooning late, and I was like, what do I want to do while I'm cartooning? Oh, you know what? I'll listen to some Comic Labs just to hear how we're doing.
Yeah.
And I listened to two episodes while I was drawing, and I owe you an apology because I realized that I cut you off all the time.
I've been listening to the show too, more than I have over the summer, because I'm back to driving to the studio, and I have not noticed this.
I feel like what was happening, can you mansplain a man? Is that possible? I feel like that's what I was doing.
You're mansplaining me?
Yeah. It's just like whatever you were saying, I'm like, hold on, Brad, hold on. Let me talk. I'm more important. Whatever you're saying was fine, but I'm more important. I'm going to talk over you.
Well, no, in fact, I've noticed just the opposite. I was listening to myself talk about the difference between talent and skill. And I was going on for so long. I was actually saying, oh my God, Dave, why don't you jump in and stop this guy? He's monologuing here.
Oh, well, I had fallen asleep is what had happened there. That's right as I get off of saying I'm guilty and I feel bad, then I make a shot at it. Boy, what a friend. What a pal.
But I thought you were going to go on for a little bit, so I took a little sip and I just about came out my nose.
Oh, well, anyway, the short version of this is I'm sorry. So this episode, everybody, you're going to hear a Dave Kellett that is respectful and waits till Brad finishes talking and speaks in short clip sentences.
Boy, get ready for a horrible show.
So, Brad, what topic would you like to talk about first this week?
Well, I there's a lot of things we can talk about, but let's talk about one of my favorite topics that just came up between you and me this past month, and that is the Patreon first day of the month dip.
Yes, the dip. All right, well, let's talk about this because I, as some might remember from a few shows back, I tend not to pay too much attention to whatever crises is happening with Patreon currently in terms of like, oh, we just messed up some software thing or, oh, we got hacked again or whatever that is. My assumption is always that they will figure it out. But anyway, I don't, for that very same reason, I don't tend to check in around the first of the month to see how the payment processing is going. And Brad and I were texting this Saturday or Sunday, whatever. I was on the couch with a coffee, mm-hmm. and I said, oh, good God, what's going on with our Patreon levels on Comic Lab? And Brad, take me through it. What did I get wrong in that moment of crisis where I was like, oh God, where did everybody go? What's happening? What's going on?
Well, the only thing you really did wrong is that you were looking at it during the first of the month. And if you go, this is a great resource, Graphtreon, GRAPHTREON.com. If you go to Graphtreon.com, and look at anybody's Patreon over the course of several months, and you'll see a big dip on the first of the month. And this is perfectly natural, and it's absolutely okay. In fact, what you don't want to see for most of us is a big dip at the end of the month, because that means that maybe people are bailing before their cards get charged. But a first of the month dip is perfectly natural in a Patreon. What that means is some of your patrons have been patrons for in their own minds long enough, and they're either going to cancel their pledge outright, or they're going to pause it for a little bit and maybe come back. That's a little tangent here. That's a big mistake people make with Patreon, is that they assume once they have somebody pledging to their Patreon campaign, they assume that that's an ongoing thing. And in my mind particularly, that's the wrong way to look at it. Those people are there for a month at best. And if you want to keep those people on for another month, you'd better be posting some stuff every month that keeps them coming back for more. That's your responsibility. But even if you're doing the absolute utmost of trying to keep your patrons, some of those patrons are going to leave, and the time that they're going to leave is going to be the first, second and third day of the month, because they see that payment has hit their card. It reminds them that you're there on Patreon, right? And that reminder serves nothing but to tell them, oh yeah, I need to cancel that. That's okay. Let those people go. If you're doing your work as a crowdfunding artist, they'll come back. You'll give them a reason to come back at some point, but don't worry when they leave. Right?
Well, yes, of course. But there was also a very weird specific flux period that's different than that. And this is what I was getting at, was that I had never watched during the moments where they're trying to process credit cards. Mm-hmm. And the actual patron count fluctuates in those hours. So you drop down, like let's say you're at 500, and then all of a sudden you drop down to 480, and you're like, oh no. But then you go back up to 490, and you're like, what just happened? I if you happen to check it during those key hours of payment processing, this is the part that I was curious about, because I'd never seen this before. What's happening there? Is it just that a card got canceled, and so that person is temporarily not listed as a patron, but then they fix it, and so then they're back in as a patron? Is that what we're seeing?
Yeah, and here's something you really have to understand about Patreon. And especially this has happened in the last 2 months in a row, as Patreon has tried to broaden how it handles credit card payments. We talked about that on a previous episode.
Yep, and you had very wisely said that this was them trying to defend and protect the credit card processing for not right. suitable for work comics, because they brought it to a less puritanical country for credit processing, right? Which they brought it to Britain or...
Exactly. They brought it to the UK. So here's what you have to understand. Even if they hadn't done that, this happens every month. And it's happened every month since I've been tracking it, said back to like 2015. But these last 2 months, it's very, very dramatic. And what happens is you have a certain amount of declined payments on your from your patrons. Now, in most cases, on a normal month, that's because their card expired, they didn't realize it, and you know how when your credit card expires or your debit card expires, and you got to change this, and you got to change that, and all the monthly payments you have set up, you got to change. You've got too many things to change to catch them all. And Patreon is going to get dropped to the bottom of the list, because it's not a mandatory thing, and it's not like a $50 payment to the electric company that you're going to get zonked if you don't make it. It's like a $1 thing, and it's the least of your worries. So what happens is your patron's card gets declined, and that gets reflected in your numbers immediately. Though, but here's what you have to understand, and here's the mistake I made. I went through every month back in 2015, and if somebody had a declined card, I would delete them as a patron, which was the dumbest thing in the world to do. Because here's what you – and don't go deleting patrons because they've got declined payments, because here's what happens. The next time that patron tries to access their account, they'll see that they're blocked from it, and Patreon will tell them, hey, you're not getting this content because your card was declined. And as soon as you update that payment, they get – now, so here's what they do. Let's say it's the fifth of the month. and they update their card today. It got declined on the 31st of last month. They update their card today. That card gets charged immediately for last month. So you get that money in your account today on the 5th. Right. They get instant access to everything that they had been missing, and then they go on and they'll get charged on the 1st of the following month. But you catch up with that payment. Patreon has it set up that way. So that's another reason. And so being the snot that I am, when Dave and I are texting back and forth, I go, Dave, that's why we do exclusive content on Comic Lab, like Pro Tips episode. Because when that person comes back to get a Pro Tips episode, and they're going to, and they've got a declined payment, that's when they're going to find out about it. And then boom, they don't have that access anymore. And the one way to get it back into shape is by making good on their pledge. That's the whole reason, or not the whole reason, but a big reason that I'm a big fan of exclusive content. And that's why I encourage people to post a lot of posts at the beginning of the month. I think I'm up to 5 or 6 or 7 already, like bang, 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 right at one after another, sometimes a couple of posts a day, because I want to have lots of opportunities right early in the month for somebody to find out, oh gosh, I've got a declined payment. This has actually happened to me, and Patreon doesn't make it super easy to go in and update your account the last time I did it, and hopefully it's gotten better. But once they do go through that process, you get the money, you get that patron back, and you go on as if nothing ever happened.
Right, right. Well, and in general, to put a capstone on this original query was basically just don't worry, don't pay too much attention for that 24 to, 48 hour period of those numbers fluctuating, because it's not just a drop. It's both up and down and up and down and up and down as that weird credit card processing is happening. Yes. And so not having seen that in firsthand before, I got a little nervous with Brad, and Brad calmed me off, talked me off the ledge there.
Well, and like, here's what we did. We had 2017 on August 31st. That's how many patrons we had. On the 1st, we had 2009. I shouldn't say 2017, 217. We went down to 209. Today, I'm looking right now, we're back up to 215. So instead of losing a whole handful, we're only down 2. And when the next Pro Tips episode goes up, I'll bet you we get those couple of people back too. And so it's not something to worry about. It's something to know that this is a normal part of the churn cycle on Patreon.
Yeah, and although Brad might say keep an eye on it, my advice is just ignore it for 3 days and then check back in on the 3rd of the month or the 4th of the month. And see how you did, because there is found out myself, there's just a weird period of flux that's best left away from your anxieties. So just check in on it on the 4th, and then take any action that needs to be taken.
Yeah. And don't panic. That's the big thing. And keep this is kind of a microcosm of all of comics. Keep your head down. Keep doing the work. Do the stuff that you know you should be doing, and you're going to be okay. You know, this is all going to work out okay.
Right.
Yeah. So, Dave, we've got a question from one of our $5 patrons that is specifically talking about something that you do that I've always kind of wanted to ask you, too. So I want to get to this one while we have a little time in the show. Okay. And it is specifically, why did you choose to lay out your Drive book? Oh, wait a minute. DriveKickstarter.com. How are we doing on that Kickstarter?
We've, as of this recording, so this is weird because people will hear this a week or two later. We're at 63,000 right now. So it's coming up on 3x goal. It's doing good. It's starting to hit that middle period where everything slows down a little bit and you're biting your nails for no good reason. But it's all going to be fine. It's all going to be, because even if it hits the most minimum it could hit now, it's made my secret aspirations for the minimum. So I'm fine now, you know?
Well, when we talked about this on the show, because I was listening to it this morning, you said if it got anywhere between 50 and 75, you'd be thrilled.
Right, right. So were those my exact words? Wow. Because, okay, hand to God, the honest to God truth was, if it made 75, I was going to be happy with it. So it'll get to there. Yeah. I 50 was just me protecting my own baby soft ego, is what that was.
That's what you're hedging your bets.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, good. I will check in on drivekickstarter.com later today to see how you're doing. But this is not so much about drivekickstarter.com. It's about how did you lay out your book for Drive and why? And here's what this person says. I'm curious about the square size. In other words, the square size of the page, mm-hmm. which reminds me of early Calvin and Hobbes collections, and about your choice to have well-defined margins. Some of the space shots especially seems like they would have looked great if they bled to the edge of the page. So what went into your decisions? Also, how early in the process did you decide on these things? So let's go deep on how you envision Drive as a print product in this process.
Great. Okay. So from the get-go, from the start, I designed Drive to fit into print. Mm-hmm. As someone who made their living at webcomics, even when I started Drive, I knew that the money's in books, not really, but you know what I'm getting at here. So I wanted to have multiple income streams for it. It's the classic thing that Brad and I have always said, which is draw it once, but get paid for it multiple times.
Yeah.
And so I wanted it to appear on the web, but I absolutely wanted it to appear in book form as well. So here's the deal. I wanted my Drive books to match my Sheldon books in size, which is not the greatest way to make a decision. I'm going to be honest about that. Mm-hmm. The better thing to do is to pick the appropriate size for the project. And frankly, if I ever had wanted to sell Drive into comic book shops, I should have picked the American Standard comic book page size, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I should have done. But I wanted my Drive books to look pretty next to my Sheldon books, which is a stupid way to do it. But it's what I did. It's fine. It's good enough. And the Sheldon books were themselves modeled after the Andrews McMeel 8.5 by 9 inch page size. So it's with absolute good reason that the Drive book reminded this listener of a Calvin and Hobbes book, because I genuinely styled my Sheldon books after those Andrews McMeel published books that were all 8.5 by 9 inches. So that includes like Sherman's Lagoon, Pearls Before Swine,
yeah.
Foxtrot, Calvin and Hobbes, you know, any Andrews McMeel published book from the 90s forward. And the reason why Andrews McMeel, just had a side note, why they went with 8.5 by 9 is because I think it was Jim McMeel figured out that he could get a cheaper produced book that was very pleasant to hold in your hand, very pleasant to read comics. You could get three comics stacked tall on a comic page, 8.5 by 9. And when you were printing the book, I believe it was either a no-cut or a one-cut piece of paper. And anytime you can remove a step from printing process, that saves you money. And so Andrews McMeel went with this 8.5 by 9 because I don't remember which one it was. It either required no cuts after printing in terms of trim size, or it required one cut, and both of which are pretty cheap.
Wow.
When you have a unique book size that requires two or three cuts, where all three sizes of the sides of the book need to be trimmed, boy, that can get expensive. So my 8.5 by 9 books were 100% copied from that format that Andrews McMeel figured out for presenting comic strips in a pleasant way. Did you know that, Brad? Did you know that that's why I did that?
I had no idea. No, I, and this is fascinating to me, because it also works into something that I had stored up for pro tips, but we'll get into right here. And that is, you should always get multiple quotes for every book that you do. In other words, for every book, you should be reaching out to a lot of different printers, because their press conditions may change at any one time. And some printers are going to use one size of paper and require one type of cut, and another printer might be using a completely different size. And you never know who's going to come in at the least expensive, right?
Right. And also, to build on that, I have had printers with whom I have a relationship now that will say, Dave, you could go with this stock paper that you've used for the last 5 books, but it just so happens that this season we have a cheaper price on a better quality paper that you wouldn't normally use because something about foresting this year, we've got, you know, a ton of trees or whatever, something happened this year. And so we've got a way cheaper price for you. And I'll go, oh, great. Thank you. So it's worth checking on both the quality of the stock, especially with the first book, the quality of stock that you want to use, and also the size paper. So you can say to a printer, if I go with a differently sized paper, do I get a price cut? Is there a way to make this work better? And sometimes you'll be pleasantly surprised to learn that if you take a 1-inch smaller or a 1/2-inch less wide paper, that you were going to save $1,000 or something. And you're like, oh, that's a worthwhile thing to do. All right, great. I'll do that.
Yep. Yep. There's one of my Evil Ink annual reports that sits about 1/4 inch lower. It's just the page depth is just 1/4 inch less than the rest of them. And that's exactly what it was. It was like, you're going to trim 1/4 inch. Yeah, I can do that. I can get that prepped in my sleep and resend you the PDF. And it saved me money. And it's such a negligible difference that it's not even worth paying attention to.
Can I disagree with you on that one?
Really?
Purely for OCD reasons.
Uh-huh.
I would have ended up paying, having already established a size for my books, I would have paid extra to get that same size made. It would have driven me nuts if there was one Sheldon that was a slightly different size.
It didn't bother me.
I'm just saying this is a personality thing that I would have looked at it every time and went, dang it.
And that's sore thumb.
But to Brad's point, he made a great financial and economic decision. It didn't make any impact on him, and he saved some money. So that's sometimes those savings can mean the difference between making the mortgage that month too. So it's it's worthwhile to take that into consideration. But anyway, that's why I laid out Drive at 8.5 by 9. And I have actually come to find that it's a very pleasant page size to tell a 3-row multiple panel comic story.
Yeah. So it's now, why no bleeds? I jump since I worked in newspapers for so long, where you couldn't have a bleed. When I get into an atmosphere in which I can do a bleed, man, I take every opportunity to bleed that page every chance I get. How come there's no bleeds in the Drive books?
Well, much like Jesse Ventura once said, I ain't got time to bleed, Brad. I ain't got time to.
That's beautiful.
What I always thought that was the most like, I ain't got time to bleed. Just the most like, I got to put truck nuts on my truck. Just that same kind of phrase, which is, I ain't got time to bleed. So why don't I use bleeds? Okay, this is the honest to God answer. I didn't know how to do bleeds right. So I never did them. That's the short version of bleeds. I never could set those files up right to do the bleed right. I, honest to God, never could. And so I was like, F it. I'm never going to do bleeds. My rule will be no bleeds.
Okay. When I come over in November, we're gonna set up InDesign and we're going to talk bleeds. You should not be frightened of doing a bleed. This is a very simple process.
Now, I want you to know as a friend, I've since done bleeds on Anatomy of Animals and on Pugs Unleashed, the two most recent books. And I think I did it on the very last Sheldon book. Anyway, short story is, I didn't do it on Drive because at the time I didn't know how to do it. And so once I've established a look, I didn't want to have suddenly on page 500 this splash page with this amazing bleed because it doesn't fit into the way that story was presented. You know,
you're right. It would have stuck out.
Yeah,
like a book that's 1/4 inch lower than the other books.
And maybe what I will do is all right. Yes, you're right. Yes, I'm a stickler for consistency.
You are. Anyway. That's what I'm seeing here. This is what I'm learning about you. That's not a bad thing. I'm not putting you down for it.
However, now that I'm saying this out loud, knowing that I have made it for, if I get through, say, 800, 900, 1,000 pages of Drive, and in the final battle, I have this quiver with one arrow left, and that arrow is to have this cool bleed, that might be fun.
Yeah.
If all of a sudden, in the most emotional part of the story, you suddenly break out bleeds, that could look really cool. So
you
maybe I will do that.
Big impact out of that. Yeah. Absolutely.
So anyway, the very human answer to why I didn't do bleeds is I could never set them up right back in the day. And so I never had them as a style in Drive.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes absolute sense.
I think, did I answer every part of that listener's question? I think, oh, you just deleted it from Wunderlist as I was reading it. Thanks, champ.
Because you did everything. You said it all.
Well, this is the joy of sharing a document over the cloud. Here I am talking, and I look over, and I'm trying to reread the question, and Brad is deleting it as I'm reading it. Well, there you go.
I didn't know it was that quick. That thing must sync, because I literally just clicked it. It must sync immediately.
Well, that's all right. That gives us a chance to go right into the question that I had for you from one of our readers this week, Brad. Do you mind if I pull up a chair, stare you in the eyes, and ask you while holding your hands about reboots? Can I take a moment to ask you about reboots?
Absolutely, you can.
Dave and Brad, on Comic Lab, you have mentioned knowing when to quit a comic and concerns about artists who never leave their high school story. You also warn to avoid analysis paralysis. What a great phrase that is. Analysis paralysis in going back and redoing your drawings with the caveat of preparing a book for print. So what are your thoughts about artists pulling a play out of the DC Comics playbook and doing a reboot? If so, when to do it? What works and what doesn't?
Well,
Brad, since you have the champion of reboots, the reigning champ, because you did it so well, I would like you to tackle this one first, and I'm going to sit quietly and smile at you as a friend that doesn't interrupt you.
So nice of you. Well, listen, here's the deal. In comics circles, the whole word reboot has gotten a bad reputation because the big two, particularly Marvel and DC, have done so many reboots and rebooted so often that they've kind of made it something that we dread. I myself finally stopped buying comics on a weekly basis because they had rebooted my characters so often. I didn't know who was who and why they were. I didn't know anybody's motivation. I had lost touch with the characters. And that is a danger of doing too many reboots, but I don't think it should stop you from doing a reboot or considering a reboot. And what gave me kind of the courage to do this was that I remembered how Scott Kurtz had done a soft reboot of PvP. And it kind of gave me a guideline of some ways I thought maybe to do it right. So here's the backstory. Here's what happened. Going all the way back to Greystone Inn, this happened at the Toronto Comic Convention as I sat there with Greystone Inn, watching people walk by having complete disinterest in what I was trying to put out. And I decided that I was going to end Greystone Inn on the plane ride back and take one of the Greystone storylines, which involved a corporation of supervillains, and I was just going to run with that for a while. And it started out as a daily comic strip, and the whole idea was just to do comic strip-style jokes. Well, as that storyline progressed and proceeded, and frankly, as I got to be a better writer through the process of being a bad writer and learning from that experience and doing that over and over again, I realized that I had created a situation in which I had blocked myself off from a lot of storytelling. For example, the two main characters, Captain Heroic, who's obviously a superhero, and Miss Match, who's a supervillain, they started out as a married couple with one kid. And I had precluded myself from all of the stories about them meeting and their courtship and their building a relationship, falling in love, having all the problems that come with that, and until finally culminating in a marriage. Anybody, like if this was a TV show, they would have demanded that progression. I had precluded myself from all of that. I had made Evil Inc. this big monolithic corporation with hundreds of employees, which was too hard to manage the setting. It was too hard to manage all of the different people. It was too big. And a lot of my characters, frankly, were duplicitous. That's a good word for you. I had a couple of mad scientist characters, and they were different characters, but they were basically performing the same role in any storyline that they appeared in. And therefore, there wasn't a necessity to have them both. They were both basically the same character. And I had some characters, again, that just weren't developed enough. they weren't funny. They weren't good for comedy. And as I'm looking at all of this, I'm like, at the end of 2015. So this was after 10 years of Evil Inc. And that's another thing. I'd written that storyline enough. I'd written it all the way through. It was time to do something new. And frankly, it would have either been a reboot or ending Evil Inc. and starting something completely new. And I wanted another pass at these characters. So I decided I'm going to reboot. Now, I would recommend anybody take that on if they feel that they're in the same place. I would have wished that I had done it way earlier. Here's the good and the bad. The good is that since 2016, I think each of the chapters of that story that I've written hold together infinitely better. And part of that is the way I applied kind of sitcom principles to writing that script. And we talked about that in an early episode. But half of that was also because these characters were just better thought out and they were at a better place in their progression to tell stories. And it led to much better storytelling. The bad is that I continually hear from people that are asking, when's this character going to come back? When's that character going to come back? And I've got to tell them, some of these characters are never going to come back because they were bad characters. You might have liked them, but they were bad characters. They didn't do the thing they were supposed to do, you know?
And would it be bad for them to be like, they're dead. That character is dead. They are gone.
Do you know I really, really struggled with that. And the way I wrote it, I kind of took the coward's way out. I said that the original Evil Inc. storyline, that universe still exists. It's just that a cataclysmic event happened and it switched the main universe in the multiverse from that one to this new one. So there's in every multiverse, there's got to be one core universe. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that one. And now it's this one. And part of that was because I didn't want anybody to get upset that there was like deaths happening. I didn't want anybody to feel like I had killed off characters.
You know what? So, I did that same bait and switch with my wife, which is when we got married, I was in shape and I took care of myself. And then what I did is I switched core universes and now I am a flabby hot mess. And so...
You've got a much bigger core than you used to.
It's very much a soft reboot. Absolutely. It's just a belly filled with ice cream is what it is.
But no, I would absolutely recommend that, especially if you, like I did, get to the point where you're like, you know what? I've made so many narrative choices that just were not good choices. I wanted to stop doing a strip and started doing more of a comic book. It was just time for change. And I wouldn't let the overall negative feelings of that comic fans have about reboots. I wouldn't let that slow you down in the slightest. Unless you find out that you're doing multiple reboots, then it's like anything. Moderation is the key. If you're doing multiple reboots, maybe you need to stop and think about that. But if you've gotten to the point on your comic that you want to keep those characters, but make some new decisions. Reboot them. Give it a shot. It was absolutely the right decision for me.
Well, there's one comic cartoonist that you and I both know that has done a soft and a hard reboot probably four times now. And follow up on the thought that you just had, at some point you have to go, maybe start a new title. This is not, you don't need to keep trying to save this one baby bird that fell out of the nest. Like it's, boy, that's a terrible image. something is not working here. And maybe the thing that's not working here is the core underlying idea. So start fresh. Yeah. But in your case, you were feeling like, hey, there is enough there that if I just tinkered around the edges, if I just moved these couple chess pieces around, this story, which I like and which works, could be so much stronger. Is that the way you would describe that mood?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I had matured as a writer and I could
matured,
go back.
God bless America.
I had grown as a writer and I could just see all these narrative mistakes that I'd made. It just bugged me. And it's like, I want another pass at that. And I do think once you've done one reboot, you got maybe a soft reboot left in you before you got to call it quits and say, nah, you know what? I'm going to do something else. And good Lord, don't be afraid to do something else. Like I've said in the past, I could stop Evil Inc. today and start a completely new thing. I could do Space Pirates starting next week. And if Space Pirates don't work out, I could come back to Evil Inc. and pick up where I left off. There's no rules. The president of webcomics isn't going to show up and kick me out. I can do whatever I want with this stuff.
The president of webcomics. I like that idea. Mr. Geiger. The interesting thing about reboots is I could see a day where I reboot Drive. More likely not, just because it's a full story that if I don't finish it, it will bother me. But I will say this. I have, after 18 years, I think now 20 years of doing Sheldon, there's been many a time where I've been like, all right, it's time to walk away from Sheldon. The joy is not there anymore.
Yeah.
And what I did is a form of a reboot, which is where I basically just said, Sheldon is whatever I want it to be this month.
Yes.
And so sometimes that's a bunch of Sheldon stories. Sometimes that's a new character. Sometimes that's, I'm just going to do Anatomy of Animals for a while. Sometimes it's the pug stuff. Sometimes it's, I'm going to do Anatomy of Authors for a while. Mm-hmm. Like, it's whatever basically I want to squeeze in there. And that's my way of saying, making peace with the fact that it was probably time to end Sheldon about 3 or 4 years ago, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, and you made the absolute right decision. And it was, I can imagine it being kind of liberating when you finally said to yourself, wait a minute, this can be whatever I want it to be. And as long as there's that core writing, that core that people are really coming to your site for, which is not necessarily this story about this kid and his grandfather, but your sense of humor specifically, that's what they come for. Once you realize that, it had to have been very liberating for you.
Right. And like there's absolutely a question of, is it branded correctly now for what it is? And no, it's not. But I don't know that I could rebrand it Dave Kellett's Sheldon or something, or Dave Kellett's comic, something like that, where it could be broader. I mean, I could. I guess another way of saying is that I don't care now. Sheldon is whatever I want it to be, and that's that. And so, and thankfully, most people seem to be totally fine with that. They've come for Sheldon, and they've stayed for the Anatomy or the Author comics or the Pug stuff or what the Coffee stuff or whatever it is that I'm doing at the moment. And so, are there a few complainers with any change? Sure. And I'm sure you got them with the reboot, too.
But
most people will stick around. And frankly, if you're getting better as a cartoonist, it'll flourish better. So, so now, when someone is approaching a reboot, Brad, what's your advice to them? What are the considerations they should take in before they reboot or restart, whether it's a soft or hard reboot?
Well, speaking from my experience, there's a couple things I did right that I would definitely suggest, and a few things I did wrong that you should learn from. The first thing is you've got to really do a major reader outreach and let your readers know that you're rebooting and why you're rebooting. I built my reboot right into the storyline. In other words, the last Evil Inc. storyline had to do with one of the characters wiping the universe out and shifting the multiverse. And once that happened, the next comic was a complete shift to a 100%, 180 degree change from Evil Inc. Just to really make the point that we're not in Kansas anymore. We've crossed the threshold. And then you've got to pair that. And I would definitely make it, you know, build it into the story if you can. But then also that's where you really got to hit social media and your blog and anything and any tools at your disposal, reaching out and say, hey, listen, here's what I'm doing. Here's why I'm doing it. And you're going to get pushback at this point because readers really only hate one thing, and that's change. They can swing with just about anything. They hate change. And my go-to story for this was at that point, the greatest amount of negative email that I'd ever gotten was when I brought aboard Ed Ryzowski to color the Evil Inc. strips. And it went from being a black and white strip to a color strip. And there were people who were really upset by this. Now, and Ed's work was fantastic. It wasn't a quality issue. It was just they'd gotten used to a black and white comic and they wanted it to be a black and white comic.
Right.
And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, looking back on it, darn it, I interrupted you. All right, that was the first time in the show. I'm feeling good about this. That was the first time I interrupted you.
It's okay.
I'm taking it slow on this show. All right, so the thing, though, is that it was both demonstrably better that it was in color, but I want to talk about one thing that was interesting that you did that I don't know that I would have done. You made a parallel link possible so that someone could read it just in black and white.
Yeah.
Whereas I would have said, shine it, you're getting it in color, that's what I'm doing now, yeah. It's color, I'm Brad Geiger, you can go eat it, you know, that kind of thing.
I didn't have that kind of courage. I was terrified that I was actually going to lose readers over this, and so I reached out to the guy that was doing the hosting and the technical stuff behind my website. And he said, oh, yeah, I can actually build it in so they can choose a preference. It'll set a cookie so that once they've chosen their preference, it'll either be black and white every time they come to the site, and they can obviously switch it back, or it'll be color every time they come to the site. And I kept that up for about a month. And I went back and looked, and nobody had used the black and white. They were all swinging with the color. Nobody had said, no, I want black and white instead of color, which proved that really it wasn't about the color at all. It was about having a resistance to change.
Yeah. And to that perfect example, I think one of the things with any decision that you make with your comic, you basically have to steel yourself to ride out complaints for about 2 weeks.
Yep.
And
yep.
They're going to be there. They're absolutely going to happen. But if you just ride them out and politely ignore them or politely answer them, basically everyone's fears kind of calm down and everyone's concerns kind of calm down. It's frankly a description of the internet, which is all these crises that flare up. If you go out 2 weeks from that point, do you really still care about the thing that happened 2 weeks ago? No, it's probably fine. Life is okay. Everything went on fine. But boy, in this moment, you're going to complain about Evil Ink going from color to color, from black and white, because brr, 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 brr. But then if you just relax and enjoy it for 2 weeks, you're like, oh, actually, this coloring is really good. I like this better. And so it's kind of a microcosm for every major decision you'll make online, which is just write out the complaints and follow your heart. Because ultimately, if you're enjoying it and it's what you want to be putting out, that means the comic is better.
Oh no, that is absolutely true. Because I had it was almost like I had a new lease on life. It's like, okay, I can take this from ground zero and just redo and correct all those mistakes I made along the way. And also flesh out some of these characters and replacing some completely because they were just boring characters. And it's like, yeah, that feels good to do that. Even though I still get emails saying, well, when's this guy coming back? Well, he's not coming back. It ain't going to happen, you know?
You know what, Brad, this discussion reminded me of something that I don't think I've talked about in decades, which is, I always tell people, yeah, I've been doing Sheldon online for 20 years, and people go to my site and they go, no, you didn't. You started in 2001. The first Sheldon is in 2001. I rebooted Sheldon. Did you know this? I don't even know if I knew you at this point. When I first joined Keenspot, which to me was like, oh, this is a big deal. I'm joining Keenspot.
Oh, yes.
I rebooted Sheldon and got rid of about 900 or so Sheldon strips between 1998 and 2001.
Wow.
And started over. And I wrote out about five characters. I had a monkey named Jum Jums in the comic. Do you remember Jum Jums, Brad?
No, this is way before my time.
He was a talking monkey named Jum Jums. And what were the other animals? There were other animals that were in the strip, gone. None of them have ever made an appearance again. And so I rebooted Sheldon basically because it had gotten too unwieldy and I had lost the narrative, and the narrative should have been this cute little family around a grandfather, a boy, and his duck. Like, that should have been the core. And I basically had let it get away from that. I mean, why? What's with a monkey named Jum Jum? And so I rebooted it, and it was a complete page one start over. Like, the archives are gone, and here's this new strip that you're seeing this Tuesday. This is the new Sheldon. And every once in a while, I would grab an old one from the archives, redraw it, rewrite it, and put it up. And that was fine by me. But that first 3 years of Sheldon does not exist online anymore because I rebooted.
Wow. That's now, did you get accepted by Keenspot way before I did, didn't you? When did you join Keenspot?
It must have been around 2001 because that's what that's when I rebooted Sheldon.
I think I came in later. I came in at the same time Howard Taylor did. I remember that. But I think you were there before.
My Swiss cheese memory, I don't remember which one of us was in the first. For those of you that don't know, at one point Keenspot was emotionally a big deal for a web cartoonist to get into Keenspot because you just felt like you were exposed to a much broader audience. And
there are two emails that I remember getting that when they popped into my browser. One of them was that I had been nominated for an Eisner, and the other was that I'd gotten accepted by Keenspot.
Wow.
And I don't know why my brain it works that way, but I remember getting those emails. I remember opening the browser, looking at it, and just being in total shock and joy.
Were on both of those emails, were you wearing the round glasses?
Let me think. Yes, I was wearing the round tortoiseshell glasses for each.
That's amazing. Everyone do a quick Google search for Brad Geiger, and you're going to see some pictures from 15 years ago with the round glasses. Boy, that was a treat. I love those glasses. So, what a dick. Why did I bring that up? But okay, so yeah, a reboot. I think there's a moment at a time for reboots. Both Brad and I have done it. Brad, I think, with greater success than I did, handled it well. But I also think one of the problems with the DC and Marvel ones, as you said, Brad, is that I know why they do it, because Marvel's audience is perpetually 10 to 15, right? It's the sort of core audience. But and so as soon as they age out, they're like, reboot. But the problem is, once you get to a certain age, you're like, I can't take this 19th iteration of Green Lantern. I don't know what Green Lantern is anymore. What does it even stand for? So you feel like all the effort and time that you've put in is wasted because, it's the equivalent of picking up Lord of the Rings and now Frodo is 7 feet tall. And you're like, what the hell? I don't even know anymore. What's going on?
But see, the interesting thing is speaking about like manga in Japan, there's a tradition where that's almost expected if it's being explained to me right. And I'm sure somebody will correct me if I'm wrong. But if I'm understanding it right, there are certain titles that you expect it to be rebooted year after year. And one year, they may be all sailors on a ship. And the next year, these are the same characters and they are explorers in outer space. And the next year, they're miners in a coal mine. There's just expected you're going to have these same characters, but they're going to be rebooted and reimagined. And it's just part of what you get into the comic for.
That's interesting. That's kind of like, if you're familiar with it, Brad, American Horror Story. Are you familiar with that TV show?
I am not. I keep my finger keeps lingering over the button to click it and start it. But sometimes horror doesn't sit well with me.
Oh, I don't like horror myself, but I've seen it over my wife's shoulder every once in a while. And if I have it right, it's the basic idea is every season is a new setting, but a lot of the actors will carry over and just play a totally different part. So if you were a doctor who was sympathetic in the first season, in the second season you're a circus carny and you're evil and you steal people's teeth or something.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting version of that. And, and the other possibility of this is like to do the Mexican boy band Menudo, where every 2 years when somebody ages out, they're like, bye, Jose. All right, Juan, you're in. You're now in Menudo. And it's kind of like Big Brother and George Orwell, where they write out, somebody like the Big Brother has always loved Minister Smith. Menudo has always had Juan in it. But anyway, so you can reboot a couple different ways there. Both with your characters being constant, but the setting changing, or with completely different characters. And anyway, it's an interesting aspect of comics that they allow for that.
Yeah. I think for now on that second, I'm just going to always refer to it as the Menudo reboot now. I think that'll be our official term for it.
You can, when someone emails you and says like, hey, whatever happened to Captain Flame? And you're like, well, Captain Flame went through the Menudo reboot.
He got Menudo'd.
He got Menudo'd. That's what happened. He aged out.
So listen, Dave, we've got one more question. We've got enough time that I think we can really delve into it. And it's one that's well-suited for your background. Would you like to take a shot at it?
Sure. I'll even read it. All right. How about this?
I'll even
read the question, Brad. I'll both answer and read the question because that's the kind of kind person that I am. All right. So here's the question, Brad. Dave and Brad, do you have any wisdom to impart on someone who is looking to start making pins soon? Yeah. Price points, how much to expect to spend, number of pins to keep on hand at conventions, design tips, the whole nine yards. Consider this an open-ended question. All right, this is a good one.
Yeah.
And before I charge into some answers, Brad, let me ask you, have you done any pins yet?
I've not done any pins. I'm a little bit intimidated by it, to be honest with you. I can't get my head around what kind of file I need to produce to make this happen. It's very foreign to me, so I'm going to be listening with bated breath.
Okay. Well, I have to say that I completely learned what I know from watching other cartoonists, so I'm happy to share basically what is a delightful margin on pins and how you can make that work for you. Ding! Okay, so here we go. So pins, roughly speaking, the average price point of a pin online or at a show is $10. The average cost to produce a pin is somewhere between a low price is $1.10, $1.30. Average price is closer to $2. And maybe if you do have some weird, funky, heavy or weird design that's complicated, maybe above $2. Now that's producing in quantities. I tend to produce in quantities of 250, 350 and up, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But you can order them in amounts as small as 100, and maybe you could even do less than that if you were willing to spend a little bit more per unit. But anyway, the margins are great because you're getting back 5 times cost on the sale price, which is lovely.
Yeah.
And, so let me take you from the start. I have only used exclusively a site called Made by Cooper. They're a UK, US-based site. This is in no way getting paid for this or anything. It just happens to be the only site that I've used. Other ones that I've heard that you could use include The Studio or True Metal Works or PinMart. And there might be more that people can chime in on the Patreon forums or on the Discord server. But anyway, those are the three or four names. Made by Cooper is great, though. I can't. They're on the ball. They apologize for mistakes. They actually credited me when they made one mistake, and it was great.
Wow.
And then what I do, there's two different kinds, broadly speaking, there's two different kinds of pins you could do. There's soft enamel with a clear epoxy on it or without the clear epoxy on it. And then there's a hard enamel. And the difference between those two is hard enamel will last much, much longer. There's something different chemically about the hard enamel. But it has less color options, and the color is less vibrant. For whatever chemically is going on in that enamel, you get less color options and less vibrant colors. So soft enamel is by far the more popular choice, and most people prefer it with the clear epoxy on it, because then you don't get that cratered look between the metal binding agent and the color fill. It tends to be smooth and almost like the edge of a glass bead when you put a little enamel on it, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, as I said, the minimum order, at least as far as I know, is about 100. And then anytime you move up, the prices drop pretty significantly on unit cost. With Made by Cooper, at least, you get 4 colors when you order. And you can add an additional color for, I think it's 10 cents a unit. The artwork is going to be vectorized to be produced in metal. So the best thing to do is either you vectorize it yourself or you draw with such a simple and clear line that you know in your heart of hearts that if someone else vectorized it, you would be okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so a way to look at that is take the simplest drawing you can do and then make it even more simple. Like this, you want this line art to be so simple because I can't emphasize enough how small a 1-inch to 1.5-inch canvas is to draw on.
Yeah.
And when you're pouring with metal, that has to be a minimum of, and I'm remembering this, I think it's like 0.2 millimeters, the minimum width of the metal. You only have so many options. So like when I did a pin of my duck Arthur from my comic strip Sheldon, there was probably 5 or 6 key lines of his design that I took out or reworked to make it work in pin form.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of a fun experiment. Like, can I make my character work in this very different design? And one of the things you have to consider when you're making a pin is that every color has to be completely encircled by metal. Does that make sense, Brad, when I describe that?
Yeah, yeah.
You can't have a yellow abutting up against an orange, and you can't have any sort of mix of color. You have to have the yellow, a band of metal, and then the orange. So it does influence how your line arc will work, is that everything has to be bound by metal.
So now you are doing this in Adobe Illustrator, right?
I tend to. draw it in raster in Photoshop and then vectorize or let them vectorize it. Yeah.
Okay.
And you're going to get back a PDF proof, at least by Cooper, you will. And your first reaction when you get it back is like, "Duh, this is not what I've drawn." But then shrink it down to a size that a pin will be, and you'll be like, "Oh, this is actually fine. This is fine." You know. And so you can either vectorize it, though, Brad, to answer that question, or I could, or they'll vectorize it for you. Mm-hmm. And then I have found that in general on the market, big heavy pins don't do well. You generally want to do a 1 inch to a 1 1/4 inch to maybe, if you're really stretching, 1.5. But 1 to 1 1/4 is a great size. And then, as I said, you get 4 to 5 colors, but then you can also do 4 to 5 different metal colors. You can do black metal, gold metal, I think rose gold, silver, and I remember maybe a steel. So there's, definitely you can do steel. So there's different metal options, along with different color options. And then you can also add in sparkles or glow in the dark or screen printing over the enamel epoxy or rainbows. There's a lot of, frankly, BS that you can add into it, which maybe for certain designs would be fun. Uh-huh. So those are all additional costs, I think 10 to 20 to 30 cents a unit. And here's what's interesting. The mold is retained once you make your design. So reorders are actually cheaper. So
because they don't have to redo that mold.
Right. So if you're on the fence about like, do I order 100? Do I order 300? Maybe do yourself a favor and just order the minimum, just order 100. And then if they sell out, if they do well, go ahead and order 200, knowing that the mold is already made. And so you'll have a little bit of savings. But you've managed your risk and not throwing too much money out all at once.
Oh, wow. That's a great point.
And so pins are great because both the margins are amazing, even if you order at 100 units, but also it scales so easy. Like a book, if you don't print a couple thousand at least, you're in trouble. But with pins, it's really easy to just try out a design and say, I'm going to make 100 of these. This is all that's ever going to be made. Oh, or something effective, like it's a trial run. And it's not a lot of money, and it's fun to do.
So now this little, when you sell these pins, they are embedded on a little sheet of cardstock. Do you put a design on there, or do they just use their own generic stock?
Oh, that's a great question. So I had forgotten that part. So I've now done 7 pins, maybe 8 pins, right? And when you're at a table on a convention, it's a nice way to present pins is to have them hanging on a business card size cardstock. And I tend to brand them all, either Sheldon or Drive. And I happen to get mine at a different site called gotprint.com. And the reason I did that is Gotprint offers a business card with one edge rounded. So it looks really cool when they're hanging on the pin rack at the convention to have a rounded edge. It looks more custom, more specific.
And you just manually attach one of those pins onto a card one at a time?
Yeah, and it tends to be during the morning or evening breakdown at a convention. I'll just do 20, 30 and then pin them up, and they're ready to go for that day's show kind of a thing.
Nice, nice.
But I don't, when I sell them online, I don't send people the backing card. I just send them the pin. And maybe I should send them the backing card. Maybe I do occasionally, but it's perfectly appropriate just to send them the pin.
How difficult are these things to mail?
They're not great in the sense that overseas is definitely not worth it to mail a pin. They don't work as first class mail. The price point gets ruined if they have to go in priority mail. And so it's a weird shape for overseas orders. But for the US, which is going to be 70% of most American cartoonist market, it's a perfectly acceptable sale price in a tiny little 3-inch by 4-inch bubble envelope, mail that off.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
And then the only other consideration is that the color choices that you make, Brad, have to be Pantone color choices.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
And so there's a certain limitation, as you know, with Pantone, with certain reds sometimes are a little bit different, or oranges or greens sometimes. And so that's the only other consideration I have that's worth mentioning. But anyway, as far as a low-cost thing to experiment, I would put this in front of t-shirts. I would put this in front of books. I would make this your first product that you ever do if you're considering something. And wow. If you're an established cartoonist like Brad, I would say, Brad, go ahead and pull the trigger. Do an Evil Ink pin for 100 units and just try it out. You're only going to spend, 100 units, you'll spend 150 150 or my math is terrible at this moment, but 150, 200 bucks, and you'll sell them and you'll make considerably more. You'll make five times that. So I would highly recommend it for people.
Let's talk one last iteration that I want to cover on this topic, and that is what makes a good pin, because I think there's a parallel between pins and t-shirts, and the classic mistake that cartoonists make when they do their first t-shirt is they put their characters on the t-shirt or they put their logo on the t-shirt.
Right.
And mostly, as speaking generally, those don't sell because your character is not Mickey Mouse. Somebody is not expressing their selfhood through your character that is infinitely recognizable. And same goes for your logo. Nobody wants a t-shirt with your logo on it.
Right.
What makes, although I can see maybe there would be a, there's a couple places like Evil Inc. might make a good pin because that's also a concept that's relatable. Like, oh yeah, Evil Inc., everybody kind of knows what that means, even if they don't know my strip. And they might like your character, Arthur the Duck, that might be a good pin. But even going beyond that, are there some stronger candidates for good pins?
Yeah, I mean, you hit on this in that the core psychological purchase here is that the pin has to represent the personality of the person that's going to be wearing this.
Yeah, just like a t-shirt.
It's exactly like a t-shirt, and you hit the nail on the head. If you make a pin that has the Sheldon logo on it or the Evil Inc. logo on it or the Drive logo on it, no one's going to buy that because that's not – it's a pin is a form of self-expression. So
right.
If Brad does an Evil Inc. logo, won't sell. But if Brad does a pin that says something like, I don't know, I'm super and I know it, right?
Yeah.
Something based on his superheroes, but that expresses some personality spark in usually some kind of first person view, that's going to get bought. Because really the person buying that, yes, they're enjoying Evil Inc., but they're buying that pin in that moment to express themselves on their clothes or on their bag or on whatever.
Right.
And so if you use that as your North Star, whenever you're designing a pin, any wearable product, you're designing it for the person, what personality will be wearing this, not someone wanting to express their love for your comic. That's not what's happening there in that moment.
Yep. They're expressing themselves, not their love for you.
Right. And it just so happens that you've wisely used your product to help them express themselves and you got $10 for it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the whole name of the game with t-shirts, and I figured that it would transfer right over to pins.
And so does that mean that I can, as many of you can, does that mean I can make a pin of one of my characters, like my duck sitting cutely on his butt? Absolutely, because some people just like a little cute, whatever kind of a chibi character on their clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean I could do my grandfather character without his shirt on and his belly hanging out? Probably not, because who wants to have that expressing themselves, you know?
Right. No, that's an important distinction, though. I mean, you can do your character if your character kind of checks off certain lists for people.
Yes, yes.
But your character, just that character, is not going to be enough. It's got to be something that transcends a little bit. So they're not buying Arthur the Duck. They're buying the duck.
Right. But if I made the pin of my heavyset grandfather without a shirt on and it said something like Haagen-Dazs forever or something like
that. Right.
Then someone might buy that because it'd be like, yeah, all right, I'm a little chunky myself. This pin expresses a bit about me, you know, that kind of thing. So you always have to just keep in mind, again, as your design North Star, that this pin is about the person that's buying it. It's not about
the
pin. So
that's fantastic advice.
When you design for that, you'll find success.
Well, that's great. I'm glad we had this topic because this is something that has been perplexing me for a long time. So thank you for sharing that.
Well, when you're out in November, boy, we're loading this trip up with a lot. But when you're out in November, I can talk you through how to do a pin and show you how to do it.
I'd love to see that.
And then you too can share the knowledge and pass it on.
You know, at some point, we got to ask our backers if they'd ever want a Comic Lab pin.
We could do that. I don't know. What would it, it's just a pin of me interrupting you. I don't know what that
is. Yeah. Just two overlapping word balloons. That'll be great.
oh my God. That's amazing. the Comic Lab pin is just Uncle Elmer saying, all right, well,
let's tag a few more.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, on that note, And you can hear, listen in the background there, you can hear that guitar playing. And that tells us that it's time for us to say once again that you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been my buddy Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my good friend Dave Kell.
Oh my God, that's amazing. And my good friend Dan Stevens. And my good friend Dick Richards.
I stuttered
What's your name again?
I stuttered on Kellett.
That's amazing.
And my good friend, longtime good friend Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at SheldonComics.com and Drive at DriveComic.com. Do check out that Kickstarter in progress at DriveKickstarter.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode, as all our episodes, was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Boy, Matt's earning his money today. Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/comiclab.